given up hope and you're down in despair. When you've given up hope and you're down in despair. When you've given up hope and you're down in despair. When you've given up.
Welcome to Illuminations. I'm Renee Moran, and I'm joined by my co-host, Deanne Phillips.
This is a show about people making ripples in the spirit sphere in the 21st century. From ancient history to modern-day innovations, we are unpacking the stories of all kinds of interesting subjects, people, and events. We're going to the very soul of the matter, and we're bringing it to you. Recently, Dr. Gary Habermas, our guest today, was honored in a book that is a tribute to his life's work. In the book, Raised on the Third Day by David Beck and Michael Kona, Dr. Habermas is described as such. Gary R. Habermas is one of the most influential Christian philosophers and apologists of the later 20th and early 21st centuries. His life's work has focused on matters pertaining to the historicity of the resurrection of Jesus, and it is widely agreed that Habermas is the foremost authority on the subject. Dr. Gary Habermas, welcome to Illuminations.
Thank you. I'm glad to be on with you. Looking forward to it.
Dr. Habermas, let me talk to you for a moment about your spiritual journey. Could you tell us a bit about that?
Well, I was raised in a Christian home, and we were attending and brought up in a German Baptist church. My family's German. A number of years into that time, a person very, very close to me at that time, it was my great-grandmother. She's the closest person to me in my early life. And she died. And it was a huge shock to me. Years later, I was reading a book on death and dying, and the author made the comment that children formulate many of their key ideas on death and dying between the ages of 8 and 11. And she died when I was 8. Well, this was years later. And I was thinking about that. I don't know if that was the cause or not, but I started on a cycle of pretty severe doubts about Christianity. I went through it for about 20 years. And at one point, I was considering pretty seriously Buddhism. And a lot of people, when they hear that, they might think, oh, he was one of these 15-year-olds who gets into this stuff. Actually, that phase was after I finished my PhD. So it was a significant time of questioning. Then later, I started teaching. I started meeting other people who had gone through a lot of doubts, very, very profound doubts for them, very painful doubts. And I just started listening and started changing my own views, because I thought doubt was just, if you're a doubter, you need a good dose of evidence. Well, I found out that the majority of doubters, that won't help them. At least it won't help them much. So I had to revamp a lot of my ideas about doubting and everything else. But that was basically what happened. I think that's how I got into apologetics. You know, I'm the guy that tried to answer his own questions. And through answering questions, you know, I'd find one more good source and one more good article and one more good this and one more good that. Well, I've got to study that. Oh, I better look at this. I better learn how to answer that. And that's, in a sense, that's my life. That my life has been as a professor and doing a lot of publishing. And it was just mentioned on the resurrection because I realized a long time ago that if Jesus was raised from the dead, makes a pretty good argument for Christianity. And it was argued that way in the early church. So the rest of my time was, well, if it's true, I want to know it's true. And how do I do that? So that's been my life journey in a thumbnail right there.
Why did you decide to make the study and research of the resurrection of Jesus your life's work?
Well, because in the New Testament, it's treated as the central claim in Christianity. And Paul, who's best known for saying this in 1 Corinthians 15, Paul says, basically, if it's true, everything else follows. And if it's not, nothing follows. In other words, another way to say it, with it, believers have the key to Christianity. Without it, there's no Christianity. You don't hear this in the New Testament, but Paul says twice in that brief passage, he says that faith would be vain if there was no reason to believe. Faith would be vain if there was nothing to believe in. So it's right there at the center. If it's true, as the New Testament says over and over again, different authors, with it, we have the Christian hope. Without it, there's no hope. I mean, there's nothing to hope in if your hope is in the event. So it all depends on the resurrection. I think it's the key to the Christian faith. And I realize that if I could answer those questions, my doubt would be calmed. And that launched me into my study.
So you did talk a bit there about why the history of the resurrection is important to Christianity. What makes it also very remarkable?
I think what makes it unique is that there are a lot of pieces of data that contribute to knowing the resurrection appearances occurred. Now, the New Testament doesn't describe the actual resurrection. It doesn't say Jesus came back to life and he stood up inside the tomb and folded the grave clothes and disappeared through the walls. It doesn't talk about the resurrection event. What we call resurrection, we usually mean that the resurrection is implied by the fact that a man who was dead was seen many times in many ways by different people, and it's the appearances that we're actually talking about. And they're the ones that can be measured up historically. In fact, skeptics, I've made a life of reading the skeptics. I read more skeptics than I read believers. And you can line up the best known skeptics. Now, I'm not talking about people who call themselves scholars and they are self-proclaimed scholars. I'm talking about the people who have positions and degrees and hold these positions in the major fields that would be related to the New Testament. Fields such as New Testament, theology, philosophy, history, the classics, world religions, those sorts of fields. And the folks that study the resurrection but who don't believe it, they're either atheist New Testament scholars or they're agnostic New Testament scholars or they're Jewish New Testament scholars. And I should say Jewish New Testament scholars who are not believers. I'm not talking here about Christians who are of a Jewish background. I'm talking about Jewish persons who can be very kind and very understanding, but they don't believe in the resurrection. And when they write on this subject, they will concede that the resurrection was proclaimed immediately after the events in question. The story was told. It can be checked out. The story came from Jerusalem a very short time after the events. In fact, I mean, I could give you a list of names of scholars if you're interested, but a number of these skeptics actually say that the stories originated days or months after the event. Now, a lot of people mistakenly think, they'll say, how can that be true when the first gospel, according to almost everybody, probably wasn't written for about 40 years. Well, 40 years isn't a long time in the ancient world. We can talk about that later if you want, but it's not a long time, but that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the earliest proclamations of the event, which critics date to immediately after the appearances. And we have evidence of those reports. So I think what's striking about the resurrection appearances is that they were spoken of so early by people in and out of the faith, and the reports are available. And by the way, if you broaden this to the historical Jesus as a whole, There are many, many sources for the ancient, for the Jesus of history. And these sources are both New Testament and non-New Testament. There are a bunch of non-New Testament sources as well.
That leads into my very next question, which is, when you present evidence that Christ lived, died, and rose from the dead, what are your resources other than the Bible?
Well, now, first of all, I'll be glad to answer that. But if you ask that to atheist New Testament scholars or agnostic New Testament scholars, people like Bart Ehrman, people like Gerrit Ludemann, Jewish New Testament scholars like Pinchas Lapid, Gezer Ramesh. Now, not all those are still living today, but we have their books. And if you were to ask them, they would say, time out. They'd say, now, these are the unbelievers. They would say, if you're implying that sources in the New Testament are not reputable, then you're not doing history the way historians do history. And if you'd say, well, aren't Christian sources prejudiced? I think they would say, and Bart Ehrman does say, we have many sources for the historical Jesus. He lists, for example, 15 different sources, independent. They're not, they don't rely on each other. They don't look over each other's shoulders. 15 sources for the crucifixion of Jesus, just that event, which of course leads to the resurrection. But 15 sources for the crucifixion, and he goes 100 years after the crucifixion. So he goes from 30 AD to 130 AD. And that's very, 100 years is very fair in the ancient world. For instance, we don't have a biography of Alexander until almost 300 years after he died. The early well-known sources, biographies of Julius Caesar or Caesar Augustus are Tacitus, Suetonius. They lived probably, these Roman emperors lived in some cases over 100 years before the sources. So we see the gospel are 40 years later. And someone says, well, okay, it's earlier, but it's prejudiced because Mark's a Christian. Okay, then do you not count Roman historians who talk about their emperors when their religion, when the religion of the empire was the Roman Caesars who became gods? And Suetonius's book, The 12 Caesars, written well after Julius Caesar died, over 100 years. Of his 12 Caesars, by the names of five of them, it says, later deified, later deified, later deified, later deified, and later deified. So if the emperors are, if your emperor worship is your religion, you must not be trustworthy to talk about them. But everybody says, oh, no, no, no. What they say about the Caesars is fine. But back to Bart Ehrman. In his 15 sources for the crucifixion of Jesus, a number of them are outside the New Testament. And I'm just thinking through his list. At least two of the 15 are not Christian. They are Tacitus, the Roman historian just mentioned, and Josephus, the non-Christian Jewish historian. So, in fact, in a recent dialogue on Jesus' existence, a group of skeptics said that the best secular sources for Jesus are Josephus and Tacitus, the same two. Anyway, long answer. I'm sorry about that. But I mean, sure, most of the sources are Christian, but nobody raises that objection for Romans writing about Roman emperors who were God, who are thought to be God. We don't have a source for Alexander earlier than 280 years later. There were people who wrote about Alexander during his lifetime. But here's the problem. We don't have the books anymore. Now, somebody may be digging in a monastery someday because monasteries have preserved a lot of things that are not Christian. You know, a lot of writings depended on the monks. And we may find a biography of Alexander someday. But as far as anybody knows, the earliest biography of Alexander is about 280 years after his death, almost 300. And the best known biographies of Alexander are two scholars named Arian and Plutarch, and they both wrote 425 to 450 years later. You think about that. And that would mean the best sources for Alexander are almost a half a millennium later. And when you go to other religious books and other religious traditions in the ancient world, the books were written way after the people lived. There's a book on my shelf over here on Buddhism. And the author's a Buddhist. He's a PhD, British professor when he was alive. And he starts the book out by saying, I want to make something clear. We don't have sources like Christians have. He said, they have the words of Jesus. We do not have the words of Buddha. He said, they have the words of those who studied under Jesus' apostles. We don't have that. And they have those who studied under. And he said, we don't have that. In fact, he said, he's editing some of the best sources in Buddhism. And he says, in my book, virtually every source I'm introducing is 600 to 800 years after Buddha lived. That's twice the distance for Alexander. So I'm not trying to choose the worst examples, like Alexander's the worst secular example, Buddha's the worst religious example. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying if you try to make a case for secular or religious people at that time, the year difference between the person and their writings are way greater than they are in Christianity. And plus, what difference does it make who wrote the Christian sources if the atheist New Testament scholars themselves, like Bart Ehrman, admit that this material about the crucifixion and resurrection came from Jerusalem, from the apostles, given it was in existence before Paul's conversion. Now, Paul was converted, it's unanimous. Paul's conversion was 2 to 3 years after the cross, 2 to 3 years after crucifixion. These sources, they say, predate Paul's conversion. Between the crucifixion and Paul's conversion, 2 to 3 years, they all come in that stage. Paul knew about them, and Paul was reacting to them in his non-Christian days. So if you're talking only scholars, virtually no scholars are going to disagree with what I'm saying. They're going to say, yes, we have the sources. And it's fine if they're Christian. We have non-Christian ones too. The non-Christian New Testament scholars will tell you that the Christian sources are stronger and better than the non-Christian ones, and they have no problem using, quote-unquote, the right ones. For example, they have 7 epistles of Paul that they love, and they'll let you use any of the 7.
There's Tacitus and Josephus, and who are some others that were non-Christian or identified themselves as not a Christian who were historians who wrote about it?
Well, now, when I say they wrote about them, well, I'm not talking about a gospel or anything, right? I'm talking about usually little snippets, a sentence here, 2 sentences there. If you get a paragraph, that's a lot. But besides Tacitus and Josephus, if you mean within a fair 100 to 150 years after the death of Jesus, you would have the other name I mentioned, Suetonius, who wrote the 12 Caesars. You have a satirist, a Syrian satirist named Lucian of Samosata. You have an unknown person whose letter exists from that time. His name is Mara Bar Serapion. And he writes a letter to his son saying, why don't you pattern your life after the great people of the past who've lived? And he mentions several major figures from the ancient Greco-Roman world. And one of them is this Jewish Messiah figure he mentions. You need to see what these great people have done. And that letter exists in the British Museum. I mean, I could go on and list a number of them if you want, but I wrote a book years ago called Historical Jesus, and I have about 12.5 sources for the life of Jesus, all non-Christian, and all from the crucifixion up till about 100 to 150 years after the crucifixion.
In the movie, The Case for Christ, when Lee Strobel came to see you, is that right? The type of information you gave him?
Yes, when he asked me about it, many of the people who believe Jesus never lived. Okay, let me cite Bart Ehrman, the atheist New Testament scholar. He says, he wrote a book called Did Jesus Exist? And he answers, absolutely. And he goes off on those who call themselves scholars who think Jesus never lived. And he's kind of hard on them. And he's the one that gives all, that's where you get the 15 sources for the crucifixion. And this guy's an atheist. So he says, he's got a little section in the book where he says, do I say this is true because the New Testament says it's true? He says, absolutely not. It's not true because the New Testament says it's true. It's true because I'm only using the credited portions from the New Testament. I'm only using the portions that I know stand the historical test. And once I have those portions, yes, I'll use those for the historical Jesus because they are historical sources. By the way, the best source, they will say, the atheist New Testament scholars, is the Apostle Paul. They think Paul is the number one source for what we know about Jesus in early Christianity.
So what you're telling us is that you do believe that the Bible contains authenticated historical data on the resurrection.
Yes. And the earliest information comes from that period. If you can think of these two little, very brief bookends, you've got the crucifixion, usually dated to 30 AD. You've got Paul's conversion, dated either 32 or 33 AD. So Paul is converted, his famous walk to Damascus. He says he met the risen Jesus. That event is plus 2 or plus 3 after the crucifixion. These scholars, both skeptical, atheist, believers, all the above, they put this earliest material in between those two events. So we know this material from 30 to, at the latest, 33 AD. And as Bart Ehrman says, Paul knew this stuff. He knew the data that were out there. He just didn't believe it. He rejected it, but he knew it. He knew what was being said. And then after Paul's conversion, just a short time later, he went up to Jerusalem and spent, as he says, 15 days with Peter and James, the brother of Jesus. He spent 15 days with them talking about the gospel. He went back a number of years later before any New Testament books had been written and talked to them again about the gospel. By the way, that event, Paul gives the date for it. That event is dated at 5 to 6 years, depending on whether you put his conversion at 2 to 3 years. The event was 3 years later. So 35 or 36, he goes to Jerusalem and talks to the apostles, Peter, James, the brother of Jesus, and then the second time he came back, John, the apostle John, was there. So critics think that is the clearest definition of the gospel we get as Paul interviewed these people who were apostles before him and before he was even a Christian. And Bart Ehrman, the atheist again, Bart Ehrman says, where do we get closer to the eyewitnesses than right here? Now, somebody could say, well, who told you that story about him going to Jerusalem? Paul did. Where is it? Galatians 1 and Galatians 2. There were two trips. Galatians 1 and Galatians 2. And they go, so you're going to believe it because Paul says it? Here's what, just that he would ask that question shows he doesn't know where scholarship is or he doesn't want to allow it. Because you could line up 10, let's say 10 major non-Christian New Testament scholars. They got to be in the field. And if you lined up atheist, agnostic, skeptics, non-Christian, some other religion, no religion at all, if you lined up 10 of those and said, do you accept the book of Galatians is written by Paul? And do you think that is an honest, straightforward definition of what Paul says happened there? If you surveyed 100 of these scholars, you're going to get, I'm going to guess, 98 or 99 yeses. That's how well accepted the material is. I'm not citing things that only come from Bible colleges or seminaries or pastors. I'm very careful to cite information that non-Christian New Testament scholars raise because they say you can't get closer than eyewitnesses than this material. Paul interviewed him and told us what he said. And by the way, his conclusion was, there, Paul says, they're all teaching the same thing I am, that Jesus was the Son of God who died on the cross, who rose from the dead, and they saw him. Paul says, they're all saying the same thing I am.
I'm very interested in the number of years after the crucifixion that Paul reportedly saw Jesus. How long do you think that Jesus walked the earth before his ascension into heaven after the resurrection?
Yeah, good question. Well, the only marker we have on time is that Luke tells us that he was around for 40 days, 40 days after the cross. And if you remember the timing here, the famous, the Jewish festival of Pentecost, which is 50 days after the Passover, when that 50-day period came and Jerusalem was swollen with thousands of visitors who come for Passover, when Pentecost began, Jesus was already gone. Jesus was already off the scene. So historically, that event when Jesus was ascended happened 10 days earlier. After the Passover, Luke says 40 days later, and the appearances stopped. Now, Paul says he appeared to me, and you know, maybe you're implying this in your question, but Paul said 2 to 3 years later, is Jesus still around? Well, Paul specifically says he appeared to me and I was an anomaly. He uses the Greek word. The English is, I was out of the time sequence, he says. But the Greek word is, it's a very strong word. It's the Greek word for aborted. I don't mean a fetus. I mean, he makes a reference to it being out of the timeline. Mm-hmm. I'll give you an example. I'm a professor. If I had a due date at Thanksgiving, which I did, I had a due date the Monday after Thanksgiving, and I only teach PhD. My PhD students are really good students. They wouldn't be PhD students if they couldn't follow dates and everything. So they get their papers in the Monday after Thanksgiving. What if one of my students didn't hand a paper in, but 2 years later came to me and said, oh, here's that paper from that class I took with you in the fall of 2020. I would use the same Greek word if we spoke Greek. And I would say, don't you think this is beyond the due time? Because that's the phrase Paul uses. When he said he saw Jesus on the way to Damascus at +2 or +3, what he's arguing is Jesus made an exception. Now take my late paper illustration. What if this guy said, here's my paper from 2 years ago? And I said, that's not legitimate. And he said, oh, so you don't know what happened to me, right? I was in a car accident a week before the paper was due. I have been in a coma. I just got out of that coma. And here's my work. That would be somebody who you'd say, whoa, sorry, I didn't know about that. Nobody told me anything. I just figured that when you didn't hand it in, you didn't care anymore. Mm-hmm. No, I was in a coma. There would be exceptions where the person couldn't have worked on anything, you know, and he's just not there. And you'd have to say, that's born out of due time. That's somebody who is out of the time sequence. And that's what Paul's saying, because he was an unbeliever. But the original question, the traditional time is 40 days. And 50 days later, when Pentecost comes, Jesus is already gone.
Do you think Paul saw a physical being of Jesus or more of a spiritual being of Jesus?
Well, you're hitting a real central topic here. Let me give you a little bit of a real quick history. When I was in graduate school, many moons ago, when I was in graduate school doing my PhD, it was a fairly popular view that traditional Christian teaching is that when Jesus appeared for 40 days, it was much more bodily. That, at least that's what the Gospels claim. But that Paul's appearance was not just out of the time sequence, but that Paul's was more spiritual. And that was the most popular view. That view started changing a couple decades ago. And historical Jesus studies is probably the most popular topic today in contemporary theology. The next most popular topic is probably historical Paul studies. And in historical Paul studies, because again, he's the critic's favorite. They love his writings. And they'll let you use 7 of the epistles that bear his name. You can just use them. They won't even argue. They don't mean they believe everything, but they'll let you use them because they think they're worthwhile sources. Okay. Recently, there has been a shift. And I just published an article from a critical publisher. What I mean is not a conservative evangelical type publisher. I published an article arguing that the predominant view now is that Jesus appeared bodily, even for Paul. And John Dominic Crossan, who's one of the best known skeptics today, he wrote a book. I'm looking at it on my shelf, and it's called The Search, In Search of Paul. And in the book, he says, let's picture two appearances to Paul. And let me use the Renaissance painters as my example. He says, in one painting, and he shows the paintings in his book, Paul's lying on the ground on his back. His hands are up in the air, and Jesus is seemingly up in the clouds. I don't mean like where a plane flies, but I mean a little over Paul's head. And he's seeing this vision of Jesus. And then Crossan says, here's the other one. And Paul's walking along the road, and Jesus appears right in front of him as a regular person. If you'd see him, you'd say, oh, there's a traveler. And Crossan says, which one did Paul see? Which one? Paul on his back, a lot of glory, sees Jesus, or Paul seeing a man he could have shaken hands with? And Crossan decides, he and his co-author, Jonathan Reed, they decide that the bodily appearances are correct. So if Dom Crossan would say that, he's a skeptic, nice guy too, he's an extremely nice guy. He is, Gerrit Ludemann, the two I mentioned earlier, Gerrit Ludemann, an atheist, German New Testament scholar, he doesn't believe in the resurrection, and he thinks the appearances were bodily. You go, well, how can he believe the appearances were bodily if he's not a Christian? Well, no, he thinks the earliest reports are that the appearances were bodily. So I'm just giving examples where that's changed recently. There are people who think that Paul's appearance was even a little different than the ones to the 12. He wasn't just out of time, but it was a little different form.
I know there's been a lot of controversy about the actual crucifixion. Can you tell us about some of the historical evidence that Jesus was crucified and he actually died?
Yeah, you know what? It's interesting you're asking about this. I am one of the co-authors on a medical article. We're hoping it's going to be published in a medical journal, but you don't have to cite ours. Other medical articles in medical journals have done this, secular medical journals. But we are summarizing the views of dozens of medical doctors who have studied death by crucifixion. And their question is, how exactly did Jesus die? Yes, he was crucified, but what happened to him? Now, there are different views on why he died. Almost nobody thinks he didn't die. Almost nobody. But the predominant view is that death by crucifixion is essentially death by asphyxiation. And they've had experiments. You go, whoa, whoa, whoa. They've had what? Experiments. Who did they crucify? All right. They've had experiments where they tie people to different kinds of crosses and they suspend them. Now, of course, no nails. I will say parenthetically, almost every crucifixion reference, many of them non-Christian, it's almost always nails that are mentioned, but they're tied, so no nails. Nobody stabs the corpse in the side, so you're not going to be, you know, but these people agree to get up on a cross. There's different kinds of experiments, but in one experiment, the men, this is done in Germany, the men who were crucified, they hung these people and tied them, and the men lost consciousness in a maximum of 12 minutes. You go, that doesn't add up. Well, what are you talking about? Well, wasn't Jesus on the cross for 6 hours, traditionally? Yep. And Pilate thought that, he wondered, is it over so fast? Well, crucifixions could be over fast, but a lot of crucifixions lasted a long time. Why? How would you know? Well, he called the centurion in, according to the Gospel of Mark, he called the centurion in and said, is this guy dead? And the centurion said, yeah, he is. Now, how would a centurion without medical training know that a person on the cross was dead? Here's the explanation. If you're tied or nailed, It doesn't have to be, it doesn't have to be the traditional cross or the crossbeam. It could be a stake. One guy in the ancient reports was crucified like on a wall of boards. You can just put them up there in a wall of boards. So you don't have to have a traditional cross, but on a traditional cross, the arms are up, and what happens is the weight of your body pulls down on the muscles that you work out in a gym, the intercostal, pectoral, and deltoid muscles in the upper chest area. And you work them out, and what happens is when you pull down on them, they constrict the lungs so that you can inhale, but you're increasingly unable to exhale. But of course, if you can't exhale, you can't inhale more than a few more seconds anyway. If the person is alive, they push up on the ropes / nails, whatever, and that can free those muscles around their lungs so they can breathe. But you can't stand up there very long. Because if you're on nails, A, it's very, very painful, and B, you're fighting gravity. So what you do is you slump back down again. Your knees bend. Now you can't move your arms, but you slump back down again. And when you slump back down, you begin asphyxiating again. As long as you can push up and breathe, barring anything else, you can pretty much live. So they would often do things to people on the cross to make sure they didn't get down alive. But in Jesus' case, if he's there for 20 or 30 minutes and he slumped down, guess what? You can't fake not being able to breathe. So a centurion could tell he was dead. But according to the New Testament, to make sure he was dead, like a not on my watch kind of thing, they pierced the body, and the traditional place for the wound is up here on the side in the lower chest area. And medical doctors, the description is that blood and water, a watery substance came up. And the medical views are mostly two, that the spear went through the heart, the water came from the sac around the heart, that's called the pericardium, and or from the lungs, if the lungs had a condition known as pleural effusion. Either way, this man was already dead. He either had the heart situation or the lung situation. And the spear wound traditionally was to make sure he was dead. Sorry for that long explanation. Besides, the centurion was a soldier. And they might not know anatomy, but they know where to stab somebody to make sure they're not moving anymore. They knew enough. They didn't know what they were hitting, but they knew you weren't moving. It's interesting that we're finishing this medical journal up, this article, and hoping to get it published in a major medical journal, because we're telling medical doctors what medical doctors say about crucifixion.
The Bible depicts Jesus' burial as being in a cave with a large stone rolled to seal off the entrance.
Right.
Are there any other historical documents that depict Jesus' burial that we could rely on?
Yeah. Okay. I'll tell you what. Again, same method. I always prefer to use the method that the atheist New Testament scholars will use. They're not Christians. And I just finished a writing about evidence for the empty tomb and done the way skeptics do it. All right, this is not the way skeptics do it. I produce more than 20 reasons, according to their writing, why we would know that Jesus was placed in a tomb and that the tomb was empty on Sunday morning, that first Sunday morning. And I could give you a list of reasons, but here's the main two from skeptical New Testament scholars. Number one is that I was talking about men a little while ago who were crucified. Let's talk about the women. The men, we're told, were hiding in fear of their lives, but the women, whose duty it was, according to if you read the ancient non-Christian, if you read the ancient Jewish instructions, it was a woman's job to finish the burial procedure, and these women were on their way to the tomb to finish anointing the body. And they wondered who's going to roll the stone away, because they hadn't given so much thought to moving the stone. They were worried about getting their spices and walking, and they had other things in their mind. And when they got there, the stone's rolled away. You say, well, that's a nice story, but how do you know that's what happened? Well, in the ancient world, not just Judaism, but all around the Mediterranean, Romans, Greeks, Egyptians, Jews, female testimony was not held in high regard as far as a court of law is concerned, unless you didn't have men around to ask the question. Now, it's not true, as people often say, women couldn't testify in a court of law. They could. Women could testify in a court of law. But here's my point. If there are four people writing four gospels in different parts of the Mediterranean world, Mark traditionally wrote from Rome, John traditionally wrote from Ephesus, Luke maybe Jerusalem, but they're different parts of the world. They're not looking over each other's shoulders. All four of them say women went to the tomb. If you're trying to give evidence, you're not putting your best foot forward. Now, we do know from two of those sources that the men also went. When the women said they went and the tomb was empty, several men went and checked it out. Why not start your story there? Why start your story with the women? Real simple, because that's what happened. Why would all four of them tell the same when it was not in their best interests to tell the story that way? And that is the main argument that people use today, that the story wasn't made up. Secondly, it's a geographical argument. If you started preaching in Jerusalem on Pentecost, 50 days later, if you started preaching that Jesus was raised from the dead and there's the tomb over there, go check it out, you won't find a body in it. You shouldn't preach that sermon in Jerusalem if there was anybody in that tomb. Just not smart. Preach it in Rome, because not very many people are going to get on a ship and sail to Jerusalem, take their lives in their hands, just to see if that tomb is empty. Now, one skeptical comeback is, well, after 50 days, Pentecost, after 50 days, you're not going to be able to recognize the body. The body's going to be, there's going to be a lot of decomposition. Well, first of all, that's not true. My co-author and I, for one of our books, we talked to pathologists who take bodies out of rivers days after they're murdered and things like that. And it's not too long afterwards to identify a body. Secondly, if this is Jesus, he would have nail holes in his wrists and feet. If you can't see the face, you could see holes in the feet and so on. But here's the main point. If there's any body in that tomb, the Christian report is false. Christians didn't say, there's a body there, but don't worry, it's not Jesus. They said there's no body in the tomb. So those two reasons, I think, are the two best. Women witnesses when nobody's twisting your arm to tell that story. And secondly, it's in Jerusalem, and that's where the story is being told. And Bart Ehrman, again, is one of the best sources. Gerrit Ludemann, the two atheist New Testament scholars, they're two of the best sources that this preaching did take place in Jerusalem. Well, it's pretty silly if the tomb was full.
So you use what you call minimal facts when you make the case for the resurrection.
Right.
Could you talk about those minimal facts? And you don't include the empty tomb as one of those minimal facts. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, no, I don't. That's a perceptive question. Well, hey, first of all, I can define the minimal facts for you. But let me say this first. I've been using them with you this whole broadcast. Because what I do when I argue is minimal facts say that if the New Testament reports 50 things concerning the crucifixion, burial, resurrection, and appearances of Jesus, if it cites, and I don't know the number, nobody counts because you don't know which one is exactly talking about the same event or one just like it that happened about the same time. Okay, so let's say there's 50. And let's say a skeptic will say, that's baloney. I don't admit those 50. How many do you admit? 20. I'm really skeptical. 20. Next skeptic says, nah, I'm even more skeptical than him. 15. Someone else says, no. I'm only going to give you a dozen out of 50. I come along and say, I don't need your dozen. You're way too gullible. You're way too conservative. I only need 6. And the 6 I choose are conceded by 90-something% of all scholars who work in this field. That's my only rule. You have to work in this field. If your PhD is in English, I'm sorry, it's not going to be part of my interview. Just like a medical doctor isn't going to ask his newspaper delivery person about heart disease. And I will use what the skeptics use. I will cite only skeptics. And I come up with 6. And we've been talking about them. Jesus died by crucifixion. Disciples thought they saw him risen. They had experiences. They believed he appeared to them. They believed. Their lives were changed. They were willing to die. This is proclaimed very, very, very early, as skeptics freely allow. And then two skeptics, Paul and James, the brother of Jesus, become believers because they thought they saw the risen Jesus. They're six. Say, well, now, say, yeah, you didn't allow the empty tomb. Why is that? In terms, there's two things that make a minimal fact. Each fact I use is evidenced by many other facts, which all come together. And the second reason is that's why skeptics all allow these facts. The empty tomb has as many facts as almost anyone does, over 20, a way the critics think. The empty tomb has plenty of data to be called a minimal fact. But skeptics used to reject the empty tomb about 40 years ago. And now they've been coming around and coming around and coming around, and about two-thirds of scholars admit the empty tomb today, but it doesn't reach my 90-something percent arbitrary definition of what minimal facts are. It's way more important that there's a lot of evidence for each one, but it's helpful when the skeptics allow it. Skeptics don't allow the empty tomb. I mean, about a quarter of them don't. So I'll just say, it's good to throw in there because a majority still admit it. So I count, sometimes instead of saying six minimal facts, I say six plus one. And I count the empty tomb, but it doesn't meet my second criterion of nearly universal agreement. So I've been using them with you. No, that's why whenever I say, you say, what about this? What about that? I say, well, Bart Ehrman says, Gert Ludemann says, Gezer Vermesh says, a Jewish New Testament scholar, Pincus Lapid, Jewish New Testament scholar. By the way, Pincus Lapid, the non-Christian Jewish New Testament scholar, believed Jesus was raised from the dead. He believes he was raised from the dead and he appeared. He even wrote a book. It's called The Resurrection of Jesus, A Jewish Perspective.
How many people saw the resurrected Jesus?
Well, there's no way to count. Now, we're told that 500 saw him at once. We're also told that all the disciples saw him at once. We're also told that all the apostles saw him at once. And those two are separate. They're listed in the same text as different appearances. There would have to be five. If you took the New Testament literally, there were 500 on one occasion. So you'd have to have around 550 different people minimum. If you take the text literally. The appearance that is the best attested, according to critics, is the one to the apostles on Easter Sunday. So I'm going to guess that there were 11 there, 12 minus one, and the women, and maybe a few others. So I would say that first appearance probably happened to about 15 or 18 people. How's that for a short answer for once?
Could mass hysteria or the power of suggestion account for the number of people who claim to see Jesus after the resurrection?
First of all, in the medical literature, there's not a single account of a group hallucination in all the scientific or medical literature. Not a single account. Because hallucinations are something that we manufacture, and we cannot share an hallucination any easier than we can share a dream. By definition, they're subjective. Now, you ask a little different question, though, on illusion, or can somebody talk somebody into it? Somebody could say, yeah, you know what? I saw this light out there by that tree 20 feet away from me, and I've often thought it might have been Jesus. You know, people can talk themselves into things. And here's the problem. They're all subjective. Nobody else would see it. So if you were by yourself and you said you saw a light by a tree 20 feet away, people would say, well, I hope you're right, but I'm not putting a lot of stock in it. I'm not going to trust your light behind the tree. But if three people are in a group, or five people in a group, or 10 people in a group, or 15 people in a group, or 20 people in a group, we would call that evidence. And therefore, I think it's very important that the earliest account of the appearances, which is dated to right after the cross, Paul reproduces it in 1 Corinthians 15, 3 and following. He gives a list of appearances, but he's repeating a list that was from much, much earlier. He even says, this isn't mine. I'm giving you somebody else's list. In that list of six appearances, there are three group appearances, one to a group called the 12, one to a group called all the apostles. I just used them a moment ago, and one to the group called the 500. And that's how we break up the illusion, autosuggestion, hallucination. Critics who don't want the resurrection to be true don't like group appearances. Two people can hallucinate at the same time. A group of people can talk themselves into something, like a magician. A magician could make an event, could make something that people could see and think they saw something. But we call them illusionists for a reason. If you get up there, they don't want you to get too close, right? They don't want you to get too close when they're doing these tricks, especially if you know what the tricks are. So to say that people could see that and nobody could disprove it, and they would be willing to go to their deaths, and many of them did go to their deaths without ever checking this out, that just seems to be a little far-fetched. So sure, more than one person can have an experience, but it won't be the same experience.
Jesus arising from the dead would certainly be a miracle. Do miracles exist historically and now?
Well, great question. You'd have to define what a miracle is. Traditionally, even by people who don't believe in miracles, a miracle by definition is an act of God. It would have to be a supernatural event. A miracle by definition would be have to be something outside the natural order. David Hume, the famous skeptic who didn't believe in him, he said it would have to be an event brought about by God or an invisible agent. There are modern accounts, three different authors, two of them written by medical doctors. One was a Mayo Clinic MD, PhD, and two of the three medical doctors. And they give documented cases of things that are very difficult to explain without being some supernatural influence. Here's one of them, just a real quick story. There was a child, don't remember if it was a boy or girl. There was a child who had a club foot. And the child was going to have surgery to open up the, you know, club foot. And I'm sure I'm not using the right language, but have a normal foot that you can walk on. And this is just the story. I wasn't there. And a minister asked about prayer over this person. And a medical doctor said, I mean, you know, I'm not opposed to prayer. So the minister prays. And the doctor said, I kept my eyes open and I watched the club foot open up into a regular foot. And needless to say, we didn't do surgery. Now, that'd be pretty tough. But there are a number of them that are equally difficult to explain. In one volume alone, there are over 1,000 cases that have been produced. By the way, a lot of people call this a miracle. I know of two studies, double-blind studies, where prayer was tested in a medical setting and published in a peer-reviewed secular medical journal. And both of them, let's just say that the information was statistically probable enough that it was published. Each study was published in a different medical journal, peer-reviewed secular medical journal on double-blind prayer results from sick people. There are some good claims that something's going on. And by the way, this isn't a miracle, I don't think, but you could talk too about near-death experiences. Today, there are over 300 documented stories of near-death cases where people report things with no observable brain or heart activity. They've reported things that they saw while there was apparently no measurable brain or heart activity. Now, that's not a miracle. It doesn't tell you which religion is true, but it does seem to say that there's some consciousness after death. So there's ways to get here. This is an exciting world because there's a lot of science, a lot of data, a lot of things to make us wonder, is this world what we thought it was, or is it a lot more complicated? And it seems to be a lot more complicated than we were taught growing up.
With all of this evidence, why do you think people still have trouble believing in the crucifixion and resurrection of Jesus?
It's because most of us do not believe or disbelieve only when we have evidence. More important to most people, according to surveys, most of us believe what we previously believed according to our own worldview. If I'm a Christian, I'm going to accept Christian evidence. Jews accept Jewish stories. Hindus accept Hindu stories. Democrats accept Democratic stories, and Republicans accept Republican stories. We know how this goes. Mm-hmm. And for many of us, it's not the data. It's you have to bowl me over with stuff to ever get me to change my mind. Very few people change their views later. Now, there's a lot of cases. Apostle Paul is a good example. If my best friend was a single fellow, and I'm of the conviction that marriage is the best state in which to live, and he just makes fun of me and says, that's not true, there's other things, and I'll say, all right, great. Can I set you up with a blind date? And the guy goes, I hate blind dates, but because you're my best friend, I'll trust you. And the person gets to know the person in question who they did not previously know. And you as the best friend say, what do you think? What do you think? And they'll go, this person is the most remarkable person I've ever met in my life. You're definitely right. I knew it. I knew you'd say that. Can I be your best man? Hey, look, bud, I can agree with you about this being the neatest person I've ever met, but read my lips. I don't want to get married. All right. Does best evidence equal marriage? No. Does that have to be the result? No. Why not? Because people do what they want to do, and they make their own decisions for their own reasons. Faith is the same way. Political parties, same way. We generally believe what we want to believe and reinforce our own beliefs. But to use my example, the best person for you does not always equal marriage. And a person can say yes to the evidence and not say yes to following Jesus. And you can say that about any religion. You can say yes about Buddha stories and not say yes to Buddha.
You've written over 40 books. Can you tell us about the last one you wrote that was published?
Yeah, it's called Evidence for the Historical Jesus. And I just found out today that it's kind of high on the list of new publications listed by secular publishers. Now, my publisher tells me it's only sold a few copies. So, you know, this is the old story of sometimes people make prognostications on what the big sellers are right now when they don't even have a lot of copies. They just do it, I presume, based on where they think this book is going and the ethos at the present. So, but it's called Evidence for the Historical Jesus, and it just came out, I mean, like a week ago.
Where can someone find your books?
Well, that one is an ebook you can get online, but it also came out in paperback. So it came out in paperback and as an ebook. So I guess you could order from Amazon or any of those groups.
We've been talking with Dr. Gary Habermas, whose life's work has focused on matters pertaining to the historicity of the resurrection of Jesus. Dr. Habermas, thank you again for joining us today.
Enjoyed a good interview. A lot of good discussions here. I enjoyed the time.
Thank you for joining us for Illuminations. Tune in next time for another interesting guest and another interesting story.
The opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of Red River Radio, our staff and advisory board, or LSU Shreveport.